Blog Talk Radio.
This isn't the Matrix.
No. It's another training program designed to teach you one thing. If you are not one of us, you are one of them.
What are they?
Sentient programs. They can move in and out of any software still hardwired to their system. That means that anyone we haven't unplugged is potentially an agent. Inside the Matrix, they are everyone, and they are no one.
We have survived by hiding from them, by running from them. But they are the gatekeepers. They are guarding all the doors, they are holding all the keys, which means that sooner or later, someone is going to have to fight them.
Someone.
I won't lie to you, Neo. Every single man or woman who has stood their ground, everyone who has fought an agent has died. But where they have failed, you will succeed.
Why?
I've seen an agent punch through a concrete wall. Men have emptied entire clips at them and hit nothing but air. Yet their strength and their speed are still based in a world that is built on rules. Because of that, they will never be as strong or as fast as you can be.
What are you trying to tell me? That I can dodge bullets?
No, Neo. I'm trying to tell you that when you're ready, you won't have to.
Out. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Cap, his mic out?
I don't know.
All right.
So in the meantime, I'll give you the floor. Start the conversation.
All right.
Keep your mind, sir.
All right. Before I begin, let me step into my other realm for a quick second and give a public service announcement to everybody out there. Folks, you're listening to the Comic Shop. It's me, Del B, and that's the captain, and Afro Nerd should be joining us shortly. And I would like to just remind everybody, all right? You've seen the Riley Cooper situation that just happened, okay? Folks, we are in the age of video cell phones, picture cell phones, and portable machinery that could take whatever you do in public and transmit it via the World Wide Web instantaneously. Mind yourself, because there is no pause button. When you say something, it's going to be out there. There is no take backs. This isn't elementary school. There is no take backs. If you mess up, be prepared to live with the consequences. Like Riley Cooper is now, I had a respect for the kid, but yo, you have to know, you're gonna say something inflammatory in this day and age, everybody's gonna hear about it, and that's how you're gonna be portrayed. Any thoughts, Cap?
For the uninitiated, Riley Cooper is the wide receiver for the Philadelphia Eagles that's catching all of this flack pertaining to using the N-word at a concert. That's what the great Daryl B is talking about. That's all. Well,
okay.
Daryl B.
Yeah. I'm sick of it, you know. And it doesn't matter that he's an athlete, all right? I'd be saying it to a rock star. I'd be saying it to Joe Blow on the street. You say the wrong thing in public, all right? Or even with your friends while drinking, and somebody goes, hey, you know, be funny, I'm going to take this right now. And they post it, guess what? It's no longer you. It's out there forever. You can't erase it. So Riley could do all the mea culpas he did. You know, you said that in a fit of drunken anger towards a black security guard.
All right. I think we got Afro Nerd right here. Let me see if I can bring him in.
Hey.
Hey, what's up, man?
There he is.
I don't know what the hell happened. Did everything go on or just what happened? I didn't hear anything.
Well, we had part of the intro and then that was it.
party intro, and then about 2 minutes of the silence, and Captain brought me in.
All right, no problem. All right. Captain, you're going to have to man the boards because I don't know what's going on my end. I can't hear anything. Everything's just kind of just stuck.
Sabotage.
Where's the Beastie Boys when you need them?
Okay, listen, folks. Again, this is the comic shop, the corrective comic shop. Unfortunately, these things happen. Did Dave come in yet? Dave Walker?
I think someone was here. We have a 312. Let's see. Yes,
I don't think that's
just him here.
I don't think he's three.
Mr. Dave Walker.
That's me right here.
Yes.
There he is.
Yes, welcome, sir. Sorry for the mistakes, but technology isn't exactly where it's supposed to be. They have us fooled. They have us fooled. Welcome, sir. Welcome as always.
Thank you, thank you. I was worried I wouldn't get through, and then you would think that I didn't know my time zones, and yeah, so you know, all's good.
These things happen.
Yes.
Again, folks, this is the Comic Shop, the Grindhouse edition of the Comic Shop, August 3rd, getting closer and closer to our own comic convention. Dave, did you get a chance to check out the comic convention on your side of the world, the San Diego Comic-Con?
Yes, I just got back a little over a week ago from Comic-Con, which is a madhouse. It's not a comic convention anymore. It's all pop culture. Comic books are like maybe fourth tier compared to what's all the other stuff that's out there. But it was an amazing show. I'm not going to lie. I had a great time, and I had a couple rock star moments, so it was good. And I'm coming out to New York, actually, for the first time for that show.
Terrific. We'll probably get a chance to see each other because I'm definitely going to the New York Comic Con. I just purchased Friday's tickets, and I'll probably get Saturday's tickets. And that's going to be a madhouse as well because just by the ability or the inability to get tickets, I could tell New York is definitely on the heels of San Diego. So hopefully we'll catch up. Listen, I got you on because a couple of things. Obviously, you're a friend of the show. And we really took a great deal of a liking to your number 13 comic, which is still available to our listening audience. We wanted to know actually what's new on the horizon? Anything new coming from your neck of the woods? Excuse me.
Actually, there's quite a bit of stuff coming off the heels of Comic-Con, where we announced the efforts to turn number 13 into a live action production. Myself and Robert Love, my partner in crime on the comic, which is coming out, by the way, in trade paperback later this month through Dark Horse Comics, we partnered up with some guys out of L.A. to try to get a live-action number 13 film up and off the ground. And we debuted a proof-of-concept trailer at the show that was really well-received. So we've been taking meetings for 2 weeks now. And I'm actually in the middle of trying to finish up a screenplay for a potential live-action version of the comic. So that's one really big thing. But that's still sort of nebulous and ill-defined. I've got two other projects that are coming out. One is a comic that I've written called The Army of Dr. Moreau. And and the thing is, I can't say who the publisher is yet because they haven't announced it. They want to make the announcement. But that book will be out in either October or November of this year. And that's exactly what it sounds like. It's The Army of Dr. Moreau. If anyone who's familiar with H.G. Wells' classic novel, The Island of Dr. Moreau, this is
a sequel.
It's a sequel that takes place in the 1930s, and it deals with Nazi scientists unlocking the secrets of Dr. Moreau and the attempts of Allied forces to stop them. So that's one I'm really excited about. And then I've got another comic that also, this one doesn't have a publisher yet. And so it's a little, everything's still sort of up in the air. But I'm working with a gentleman named Philip Buchanan, who he was drafted by the Oakland Raiders. He was in the NFL for several years.
Atlanta Falcons.
Yes. And so Phil is trying to, not trying, I should say, Phil is a writer. I think a lot of people don't know that about him. And so we were introduced a while back, and he had an idea for a comic project, and I've come on board. I'm helping him write that. And that is, we're working with an artist that's amazing on that. And I don't know the full details of the publishing details yet, although I suspect an announcement will be happening on that hopefully right around the time New York Comic Con rolls around. And that's called the Supernals Experiment. And Phil's been great to work with. He's just been, you know, a lot of really great ideas. And it's, you know, a lot of times when you're talking about professional athletes branching out into other things, you sort of roll your eyes and go, oh, yeah, okay.
Folks get nervous sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. You know, because they start thinking about, you know, the Super Bowl shuffle or something like that. but I would say Phil Philip is just a really great guy with some great ideas. And one of the things we talk about in our collaboration is, like, you know, I couldn't get on the field right now and play football even if I tried. I'd get knocked down, like, within a matter of seconds. He's got more skills as a writer than I have as a football player. Let's put it that way.
Wow.
And so what I've just been doing is collaborating with him and you know, just sort of helping him get a lot more polish to what he's to storytelling. And I keep telling him that, you know, at some point he can get rid of me and go solo, do it on his own. So that's a great project too. So I've got two comics that'll be out, you know, hopefully by the end of this year, and then just working on my novel and working on the screenplay for number 13 and all kinds of crazy stuff, you know?
Which means by the time Comic-Con comes around, I got a lot more snooping to do. And it's a great thing. It's a great recent trend, because I know Lance Briggs had a comic that he self-published through, I want to say, Acclaim. I'm not too sure about that. So, and I know a couple of other athletes have also stepped up and been getting into the writing/comic game. So you know what? Hey, the more the merrier. It's part of what we've been preaching here. If you got the resources and you got the drive to do it, what's stopping you?
Exactly.
Well, you know, what I find really interesting is that, you know, it's like comics for a long time have been the realm of the nerds and the geeks, right? And I think that they feel this sort of alienation when it comes to athletes, because a lot of comic readers aren't naturally athletic folks. What they don't realize is that a lot of kids who play sports also read comics. And I think we're going to see a more bridging of the gap between those two worlds, you know? I'd like to see that anyway. Anything that brings people together, I'm happy with, you know, so...
Exactly. Well, I think the whole, you know, we've spoken about this before on Afro Nerd and on the Comic Shop, that the terms geek and nerd have been really incorporated into the mainstream culture, maybe to some true nerds and geeks chagrin, you know, because
yes.
Some things we like to keep to ourselves, but I think the cat's out of the bag, and everybody has embraced this whole notion of being a geek. You have a sports geek, you have all different types of geeks. So now I think the comfort zone is there for people to come in and say, you know, hey, I play football. I'm a great athlete, or I'm a great musician, but I also like such and such. I think what's the guy's name? He was on American Idol. He's a rock star. Is it Dalton or I can't remember his name.
He's a music guy,
but he's a big Batman freak. And I think he was at last year's San Diego Comic-Con. And I think he has some kind of business venture with comic books. So the musicians, the cool guys, the formerly cool guys, are now onto our side of the world as far as being cool now. So.
Yeah. And the one thing is that I think comic fans are – they're pretty merciless. You know what I'm saying? And so – If that rock star or that athlete isn't bringing some really good game with them, then they're not going to cut the mustard, you know. So
well, that's true too. You got to be good.
Yeah.
Keep in mind I think the lead singer of My Chemical Romance and Grant Morrison. They're buddy-buddy, you know,
yep.
And Grant Morrison appeared in several of their videos, and the lead singer came out with the Umbrella Academy, which has been big on the indie and underground circuit, you know. Crack Heat and Cambria, they've done a whole line of comics based on their Aftermath albums. You know, this thing is bridging and it's cool. Let's not just get any more NFL Super Pros, though. We don't need to see that, all right? No Super Pros anymore. But it just shows if you're creative enough, why not go for it? You know?
One thing before we get into the topics, and I want Dave to sit in with us on the topics. I just happened to listen to another podcast, Dave, where there was a name drop by Brian Michael Bendis, your friend, and it was kind of funny because I was envious because for a lot of reasons, obviously, because your friends with Bendis and your whole creative lifestyle. But he had mentioned that he has gotten all these pilots, like a whole, I guess, box full of pilots that he and his wife and he mentioned you are looking at these pilots that some will probably never make it to the TV. And he was going into this whole thing about Beverly Hills Cop going to CBS. And I remember reading about this, but he actually saw this thing and he name dropped you because you said, well, first of all, you said that it was horrible, but it was only good when Eddie Murphy personally showed up, and he would show up like some pixie every 15 minutes and then he'd go away somewhere and then it would start to suck. But he
start to suck. It would continue to suck.
So I wondered you if you could give us, if you can, give us a little bit of insight to what you saw with this thing, because he said that you said something interesting about how it got some things screwed up about African American culture. Culturally, it was a little off.
There were so many things wrong with that pilot. Did you mention how I basically stormed out of his house and threatened to never come back over again.
He didn't go that far.
It was bad. It was, you know, and we sit down and we'll watch stuff like that from time to time. And he was like, oh, I've got the Beverly Hills Cop pilot. Do you want to watch it? And I was like, well, I hear it's bad. And he was like, oh, it's beyond bad. And, you know, and it's only like 45 minutes long because that's how long a network pilot would be for an hour long show. But it felt like 3 hours. And it was just really, when you stop and consider, you know, Sean Ryan, who was the creator of The Shield, was the writer, and Barry Sonnenfeld was the director, and it was worse than Beverly Hills Cop 3, which was a terrible movie.
Yeah.
You know? And it was just one of those, it was like, there's this level of humor in terms of what, you know, what is considered, I guess what they think, what Hollywood thinks black people will be amused by, and more importantly, what they think how white people will be amused by black people. And that has at least shifted over the years. But this was like some 1982, oh, isn't this funny sort of thing. You know what I'm saying? There was a lot of big flashy smiles and sort of shucking and jiving. It was very amateurish. That was the thing. It was like, if you had told me, if I didn't know the pedigree of the people involved or known that there had been movies that Eddie Murphy had made before, I would never have believed you. I could have done better myself for like $10,000 in a weekend. I could have made something better.
Wow.
God. We're talking Avengers Assemble bag. This is what we're talking.
And you watch it and you just go, you know, first of all, it's like, okay, well, why Beverly Hills Cop? Isn't that like 30 years old now or something like that?
Yeah, it is.
You know, I mean, like, you might as well just do a 48 Hours movie or a Trading Places or Trading Places TV series, you know?
Which is in discussion, by the way. They are talking about a Trading Places TV series.
It's
funny you brought that up.
Yeah. But, you know, you see this stuff and you think, and I think to myself anyway, okay, you know, I would like to think an audience is more – obviously audiences are more sophisticated than what the Beverly Hills Cop pilot is because it didn't get picked up. But it was the fact that something could be this bad with this much with these many forces behind it that you would think it would have been okay. It was kind of heartbreaking. And then the worst part is like, yo, how can I get a break like this? You know, how come no one's asking me to write the Beverly Hills Cop pilot? Although maybe that's what I'm doing right now as I'm writing the screenplay for number 13, is like, maybe this will be my foot in the door. But yeah, it was sad.
Wow, I didn't know it was that bad. I mean, I know it was bad. You said it was bad, but you put it to a next level of bad.
it's the sort of thing that, like, you know, and Brian and I are good friends, so, you know, it's the sort of thing you put on when your good friends are over, but not when people you just casually know are over, because they'll be like, I don't ever want to talk to you again, you know?
Wow. Well, wow. It was like an insultingly bad pilot.
Yeah, it was, and it was very amateurish, and the thing is, you know, and this is really what it comes down to, is when you look at television, whether it's network television or, you know, some of the cable networks like, you know, what AMC is doing with their programming, but you look at a show like Breaking Bad or Mad Men or something like that, and it's like there's no excuse to come at us with something like Beverly Hills Cop. You know what I'm saying? It's like there was no – if audiences ever get a chance to see it, what they're really going to be seeing is, oh, this is what the networks actually think of us as an audience. They think we can take a property that's 30-something years old, you know, recycle it and give it to you, give you trash. And fortunately, it was so bad that it didn't get picked up. But it was still that somewhere, at no point did anyone say, this is not a good idea. And when you watch it, you're like, there's nothing in here that seems like a good idea. You know what I'm saying? You know, sometimes you watch a movie or a TV show and you're like, oh, there's a couple good minutes here and there. There wasn't even that, so...
Yeah, all the time on this show, all the time, we see stuff where we're like, if they just did this and did this and did this, it wouldn't be crap. It would just be bad.
Yeah.
Well, I do remember Bendis mentioning that Judge Reinhold makes an appearance as a mayor, and that his ears were disturbingly big. I mean, distractingly and disturbingly big. So big that there needs to be some medical intervention. I remember him saying that.
Yeah, no, he makes a cameo at the end, at playing the character he played from the movies, and the implication being now he's the mayor of Beverly Hills. And you just kind of roll your eyes, and you're like, he just has not aged well. You know what I'm saying? It looks like he's had like some monkeys or something hanging off of his ears for a few years. It's like,
wow,
weighing them down. So. And then even Eddie wasn't that, you know, like to say that Eddie salvages the show in the scenes he's in isn't saying much. Because this is like Pluto Nash Eddie Murphy, you know what I'm saying? It's not him at the top of his game, it's just, well, he's the best thing about a bad situation, so.
Wow. Well, you know what, I'm afraid to hear anything else. Let's go to something that's a little bit more lighthearted, actually.
Okay.
There's a lot of things to our audience again, folks. This is the Grindhouse Edition. We have Dave Walker stepping in. We have, of course, the gang, myself, D-Bert, Captain Kirk, and, of course, the indefatigable Daryl B. There's a lot of stuff going on about this Man of Steel, second installment of Man of Steel, Dave, with... I guess the working title. I hope they call it World's Finest, in some way. I'm not so sure about Batman versus Superman, but I guess that gets to the point. But now they're saying, I think the WB, they're saying that it looks like they're looking for an older Batman. So now there's talk of Josh Brolin, there's talk of Jim Caviezel. I mean, there's a lot of guys that are, I guess, say late 30s into the 40s.
Yeah,
that they're looking to, I guess, interpret Frank Miller's version of this story.
And so, and they've called Frank Miller in.
They did.
And I rolled my eyes. I absolutely rolled my eyes. I did not want them to make it a straight-on
Dark Knight Returns thing. I did not want that. I wanted... You know what this is going to lead to? Everybody's going to be wearing, I'm with Team Batman shirt. I'm with Team Superman. I'm Team Krypton. I'm Team Gotham. It's going to be bad. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was looking at somebody's tweet. I forgot who it was. I guess it might have been maybe Tyler Hoechlin, the young actor from Teen Wolf. I think it was him or some other actor that was put out there that might. There's a whole bunch of names. Listen, every young actor in Hollywood is gaming for that role. And someone tweeted out, and I kind of like the idea, that they said, you know, if they're going to go for a much older Batman, if they're really going to do this, just like the book, maybe they might have bring in Michael Keaton. What do you think about that? Now listen, hear me out. Michael Keaton as really an older Batman, that might be interesting. I'm not against that.
Okay, but wasn't their whole point of going the Nolan route to distance themselves from this a little bit? Distance themselves from that era? Isn't that why we went
well, this,
the Nolan
route? Well, this isn't
route?
Nolan. This is we're going back to Burton now.
But what I'm saying is the whole point of going the Nolan route and having the Nolan tentpole and putting Superman on it was to distance yourselves from the 90s, distance yourself from the 80s, distance yourself from the 60s. Isn't bringing Keaton back going to retie yourself to that in a way? I'm just putting it out there.
Can I interject something?
Sure.
I like Afro-Nerd's point, because you could always say, bringing him back in, Keaton, this is definitely an alternate universe, and then you could still run the JLA situation underneath it by bringing in Keaton. I think the audience will make that type of time. Just saying, if you use him. Because that definitely seems like a different universe when you're using Keaton automatically.
All right, okay. That's all I was just asking about. Because, you know, Keaton is still finally regarded by, well, the baby boomers, the children of the 80s, as their Batman. You know, because a lot of them rebelled against the Bale one. You know, they like Keaton as Batman. So that's what I'm saying with that. Because they've made so much effort to separate, and now you're going to tie yourself kind of back. That's how I view the movie.
Well, listen, the reality is that Batman has been around for so many decades. We're talking about seven or eight decades. That, yes, some folks that you know, I remember where there was problems because Adam West wasn't involved.
I want to see Adam West in this new movie we're talking about. I want to see him really old, 90-something years old is what I want to see.
Well,
that's just me.
He wants Batman Beyond Returns.
I want Clint Eastwood for that one. They've kind of put that out there. If they do a Batman Beyond, when you have an older, grizzled, elderly Batman, it should be someone like Clint Eastwood. He would be perfect for that. And then have some young buck to do the dirty work. Let him be the sage.
Let it go full circle. Have Adam West play the old Joker driving the new Joker gangs.
Well, listen, you saw Gran Torino. And Gran Torino, as a grizzled old man, you know, he would play that role perfectly. If you remember the cartoon where, you know, you had some young punks that were trying to threaten an elderly Batman, elderly Batman still took out a can of whoop-ass as an elderly person. You saw some of that with Gran Torino.
It can be done.
I think a good grizzled old Batman, I think Kurt Russell would make a good grizzled old Batman. He's not too old, but he's old enough. And he's still got enough of a tough guy edge to him. Yeah, he's if he's not in his 50s, he's 60s. Clint Eastwood might be a little too old. He's like 104 now, I think. I'll be honest. I'm not looking forward to this movie at all. You know, I feel like Man of Steel made a good chunk of money, and Warner Brothers is just like, they're looking for quick cash in. They're not. There's nobody steering the ship in terms of the way Marvel has, at least you know, what Disney's doing with the Marvel movies and how they've got, you know, writers and creators really sort of, you know, working in as advisors. I don't think there's any of that going on with Warner Brothers and the DC stuff. It's more, I mean, Green Lantern is proof of that. They're just like, hey, let's make a movie. And so, you know, if when I hear whether it's going to be called World's Finest or Batman, the moment they say Batman versus Superman, I think of, my mind first thinks of King Kong versus Godzilla, and then it goes to that Freddy versus Jason movie.
Oh, yeah,
and
oof.
You know, and King Kong versus Godzilla is a classic. I mean, we all grew up watching that on, what, Channel 9, whatever it was. But Freddy versus Jason was terrible.
That's a further example of what we were talking about before. There were parts of Freddy and Jason that fans of both franchises were like, cool, but then you put it all together in the movie, like, this could have been much, much better.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's my concern. My concern is that a Batman, Superman movie would be something more like that, more like a Freddy versus Jason thing, where there's a couple cool moments, then, like, you know, I came out of the Avengers, and I felt like, you know, I could actually watch an Iron Man and Hulk movie, you know, or I could watch a Captain America and an Iron Man movie, something like that, but I haven't seen anything in any of these DC movies that's even hinting that that's possible. There's no cameos by other characters, nothing, you know, so.
Well, you know what, that's something that we talk about incessantly at the comic shop, and I think it boils down to is the real distinction between Marvel and DC. As much as I love comic books and I buy, you know, multiple, I buy from Dark Horse, I buy from Image, I buy from different companies, but DC has set up such an iconic group of heroes that they're godlike, they're not human. Marvel has really, you know, I've always said this, that Peter Parker lives in Forest Hills. You know, that's pretty, you know, that makes it more tangible. You know, he wasn't a billionaire. He was a nerd that was raised by his aunt. You know, those kind of things people can relate. But, you know, the way that Batman is more relatable. But everybody else, you know, they live in fake towns, you know, Metropolis and Gotham, which are supposed to be, I guess, mirrors of New York. But the reality is that, you know, that makes it difficult for movie making, I think. You know, it's I don't know. Even this Superman, it's Man of Steel. I liked it, but it didn't make Iron Man money. Since in what universe would you think Iron Man makes more money than Superman?
Well, but I think that's also just a reflection of the you know, the Iron Man thing caught a lot of people off guard. I was like, how is this going to be a good movie, Iron Man? You know, but There just seems to be a different attitude in making these movies. You know, I mean, you look at it didn't do tremendous box office, but you look at a movie like Pacific Rim.
Oh yeah, well.
And at the end of the day, Pacific Rim is about as outrageous a concept as you can find, and yet people went to go see it. And so I think that, like, Wonder Woman, if someone came along, a good Wonder Woman movie is possible. Will they actually make it? I don't know. But I mean,
now you sound like me.
That's also why I said it's a good thing that they got Del Toro's foot in the door at DC doing the Shadow Pact Justice League movie. Because the one thing with Pacific Rim, I said it for weeks before the movie, I have yet someone disprove it for me. In that 2 hours, he set up a mythology. He set up a methodology. He set up a tangible physics, and he laid the groundwork for, if we decide to do a sequel, we could do a sequel. We got tangible heroes. We got he laid all of that down in 2 hours. That's something DC with some of their hero movies hasn't been able to do in what, 15 years. Lay down the possibilities of expansion. He did it with Hellboy. The Hellboy 2, he laid the groundwork. He laid the whole mythology. He, you know, Del Toro there, like I said, Del Toro said, yeah, my Shadow Pact, my Dark Universe, my Justice League Dark movie,
with no other DC movie is done. Watch. There is a bigger DC universe out there. And I stood up and cheered. And I went like, yeah, this is great. And then I thought to myself, oh, God, once the Warner Brothers suits see this, they're going to try to muck things up.
Yeah, you know, and that's one thing about Pacific Rim. I really enjoyed that film, and I think that it's really fighting it for an audience. I mean, from my understanding, it was number one internationally, and it maybe brings more critique as to why America has to be, you know, if it doesn't do well in the States, then we're led to believe that it's a dud, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. I mean, just because it does poorly in this country doesn't mean that, you know, it opened up in China a few days ago, and China, from my understanding, loves this film, obviously. I mean, you know, internationally, it should make its money internationally. I want Del Toro to be successful with this film so, A, he can do another one, and, B, like you said, if he gets a JLA Dark, everything's incumbent upon how well you do at the box office. You know, you're only good as your last film. So it's very important for him to really succeed this time if we are to see a JLA Dark. So I hope it works out. It looks like it might work out. Internationally,
well, you know,
it's going to make its money.
Yeah, Pacific Rim, I mean, they it's made about $230 million worldwide right now. It's, you know, it's made, most of its money's been from foreign versus domestic. But I think that when I look at the trailers for Pacific Rim were great. They got me really excited. But I think that it got a lot of nerds excited, whereas I think, I can't remember who actually released the film, who the studio behind it, Warner Brothers.
Legendary.
But I think that they just didn't, they really kind of fumbled the ball on marketing it, because at the end of the day, I thought it should have been a much bigger hit over the summer. I thought it should have been probably the biggest hit of the summer. But it was like they didn't quite know how to market it. They were afraid that, you know, it was like, oh, maybe American audiences won't get into the concept of the giant robot, or, you know, and I was like, it's Transformers versus Godzilla. Basically, that's all you have to sell it as. But they tried just a little too hard to explain stuff, as opposed to, because I thought, again, Del Toro did a great job of setting up that world. The first, like, what, 10, 15 minutes of that movie, it's just like, boom, boom, boom. You get it all explained to you. It's like if you haven't figured it out within the first 10 minutes, you're never going to figure it out. You're never going to accept it. And I think I agree with you guys. I think he's a great filmmaker. I think Pan's Labyrinth is one of the best movies of the last 15, 20 years.
Oh, yes.
You know, both the Hellboy movies. And I think that that's a filmmaker that, like, you know, Warner Brothers is scared to, I mean, they've given all this power to Christopher Nolan because of the Batman movies, right? But then you look at what happened with Green Lantern, and it's proof that they're not really thinking it through. They're not looking for writers who know what they're doing. They're not looking for directors who have a clear vision. You know, they got Zack Snyder, I think, simply because Zack Snyder's proven he's got a fan following. And, you know, Watchmen made a lot of money, and 300 made a lot of money. And it's like, oh, he can do something. Whereas you look at some of the choices Marvel's made with directors, and it's kind of like, really? Who would have thought? And yet Marvel hasn't made a truly terrible movie. I mean, there's been some bad movies made with Marvel characters, Ghost Rider, Elektra, Daredevil, all that stuff. But when you look at the Captain America, Thor, Iron Man movies, all that stuff that's part of that shared universe, there hasn't been a terrible movie in that bunch. There hasn't been anything that compares to either Green Lantern or, like, say, Daredevil, you know?
Well,
and that's because they take a vested interest, I think.
Well, also, you know, you mentioned that, you know, one thing, if for those who are really into this stuff and know what's going on, an explanation for what you just mentioned was, well, you know, those other movies aren't really part of Marvel Entertainment. They're part of Fox, they're part of Sony, or what have you. But everyone's waiting, like, okay, if the rights were to revert back to Marvel, we can get things cooking again. I think Daredevil has reverted back to Marvel, Ghost Rider has reverted back, and Punisher.
Pretty much everything except the X-Men universe and
FF.
And Fantastic Four, and Spider-Man. And Spider-Man, they're never going to let that go. Sony's never going to let that go.
X-Men and Spider-Man, we are not going to get back anytime soon. Just their name makes money.
But I'll tell you what will happen at some point, if the money is right, you'll see Sony and Disney team up to have Spider-Man in an Avengers movie or something. If the money is right, that's the only thing it comes down to. It's always about money. And you see that with the new X-Men movie, they're scrambling to get all these characters in there so that Fox can lay claim to certain characters.
But they need to listen to Hugh Jackman. They need to listen to Hugh Jackman.
And
Hugh
Josh Whedon and Mark Webb.
Let's get this together already. Stop being greedy little kids. Let's not be Lars Freeze here. Let's just get this together. And the second thing, too, kudos. Kudos to Mr. Singer and whoever was behind the Trash Industries viral
commercial
campaign,
right.
Yeah.
That showed part in the Wolverine movie and fully on that. Yo, that thing, the two things that have hit online this past week that have gone just nuts is that and the Venom short, the Eddie Brock short in the vein of the Punisher laundry thing. Yo, those two things, they just took off. People were like, oh, my God, you saw the Sentinels? Oh, that's Eddie Brock. Is it that Venom? Like, yeah. Oh, I can't wait for this to come out. You know, and there it is. That's the one thing DC can't do. Or they're reluctant to do. They can't put in, okay, we're going to devote. They do a great job with the animated things, with the DC Nation shorts. More often than not, those have been gold. But when it comes to live action, they just nickel and dime it to death, and they change essential parts of the characters. And that's kind of why we were hoping here for a long time. Hey, just go across the way, get Bruce Timm, get Paul Dini, have them look at your live action stuff, and they'll tell you right away where you've messed the characters up.
Well, let's do a segue point. Actually, I'm not able to play music. Captain, you still have the boards, though, right? You have access to the boards, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, we'll go into that for the next show. Right now, we'll just flow with the discourse. Great company, great discourse, and you know these things happen with the technology, so it is what it is. Segue point. More still on comics, of course. We're hearing now that Arrow season 2 looks like it's going to be something spectacular. And let's hope it's spectacular. Let's put it that way. I'm crossing my fingers. But not only are we going to see more, I guess, more villains from his rogues gallery, but now there's talk that we might see Barry Allen. I'm assuming it's going to be Barry Allen come through Arrow's town, and it will probably end up being a spinoff. Daryl, you first. What are your thoughts about this? Is this good or bad? Is this still going to be a Flash movie? I mean, it looks like Warner Brothers did not. They're just throwing things up against the wall. He's going to be on TV. No, he's going to be in a movie. What's going on here?
Okay, the bad of this is, sorry, Cap, they pushed Amazon to the back burner again. So maybe that's a good thing in the long run, but Amazon gets pushed to the back. For the bad thing, it looks like my joking prediction might be a little right, because they're talking about, forget the dude's name, but that he might end up with a green ring, you know? So he's
Diggle.
Going to be
what, Diggle?
Really? Diggle. It turns out, and they were joking about this at the Comic-Con, that, you know, his family name is actually Stewart, right? And I was like, oh, they did not just say that. No. But there's talk. You're getting Black Canary this season. You're getting Flash this season. You're getting Hal Jordan.
Let
me repeat that. You're getting Hal Jordan. They didn't say Green Lantern. But
okay.
You may get a Hal Jordan appearance.
Right, he just might be a pilot or something.
Yeah, like he's a pilot or he's being interviewed on television. But you're gonna get a Hal Jordan thing this season. All right? At least that's what they were hinting. That's why I joke about Diggle getting the Green Lantern ring and his family's name being Stewart, but guess what? They actually said it during the panel, so they're probably yanking all of our chains. The Flash thing, simply put, is this. The movie, they don't know what direction that they're going with the movie. So essentially, they're going to use the TV series, or they're going to use Arrow to gauge the fans' reaction to Barry Allen. All right? They're going to gauge the reaction. Let's see what happens. Right now, the Flashpoint Paradox was released, and it's doing fairly well. Okay? But that's animation. DC almost never fails when it comes to animation. Like I said, their hang-up has been live action. Their hang-up has been deciding what traits and what characters to keep in the live action to not only make it believable, but make it favorable to their longtime fans. Back to you, Afrinert.
Captain, what are your thoughts on this? You're a big fan of Arrow. Doesn't Arrow have a certain sense of reality attached to it? I mean, it's a little bit more real than to have people with fantastic powers attached to it. And maybe I'm wrong. Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
That's one of the main reasons why I was enjoying the series, because it seemed very real. The characters understandable. Everything flowed really nice. They, you know, the different hues of people on the show, everything was totally balanced. It was, you know, for that level budget, it was well done, you know, at that given point. It would be rather interesting to see what happens when you start introducing the superpowered, you know, characters and see which direction that it goes into. I don't know if it's a bad thing or not. I just have to wait and see. I just have to see. I might get on the screen and say, oh, my God, that was terrible. Well, you know, we'll see. You know, we just have to totally see. But as you did say, one of the main reasons why I was following the Arrow series was because it was based in reality. Time will tell, though. We'll see what they'll throw at us. Maybe they mess it all up. Maybe they don't.
Are we banking on this one? Because, you know, DC live action, you know. I don't know, man.
They mess it up a lot of times, but, you know, I don't know.
I want it to succeed because I want superpowers to be shown. And honestly, Heroes did a great job with this superpower on television. If you saw the effect the girl had, that was perfect. Matter of fact, you know, if you want it to be realistic, the old Flash TV show with John Wesley Shipp showed the realistic effects of someone who has a hypermetabolism and how much he had to eat and how much, you know, if they keep it to that without the corniness, if they keep it to that, you know, where he's not in this bright, bright red suit, you know, if they keep it to that, it could work, but this is DC.
Well,
this is DC live action.
Listen, I like that. I have fondness for The Flash, you know, the 90s series. I mean, I really liked it. But when you look back on it, I mean, the guy was wearing a bright red, velour, puffy, muscular suit. I mean, you know, I don't know. That's not going to work in 2013, Daryl.
No, it's not. That's what I'm saying. Hell, even they got it right in Smallville with Little West. Yeah,
right.
Little Allen, Bart. With Bart Allen, they got it right in Smallville, was showing how he moved and stuff, where they didn't have to gloss it. We didn't need no lightning strikes. We didn't, you know, they you know, they got that right, you know. It's just, you know, little things like having Amanda Waller be a scientist. It's little things it's not Jimmy Olsen, it's Jenna Olsen. It's, you know, it's little things that they think, oh, we could change this and this will be okay. And you're sitting down, they're like, really? What are you doing? There's so many other characters you could fit into that role. You know, that's what they, with Warner Brothers, they smell a little success and they go overboard. Arrow's been successful so far. Why are you effing with the formula?
That's the only thing. And if you're going to F with the formula, come on, man. Just make it work, gosh darn it.
Well, let's ask our guest what he thinks about it. Dave, what are your thoughts? I mean, first, what are your thoughts about Arrow? And what are your thoughts about the supernatural? Now you're talking about the supernatural kind of entering the Arrow universe. What are your thoughts?
I haven't given Arrow enough of a chance this first season just because I've been so busy with everything.
I can imagine.
Like, I don't feel comfortable weighing in on Arrow specifically, but what I do feel comfortable weighing in on is the fact that when you look at the popularity of shows like, you know, all the various Star Trek, you know, spinoffs over the years, whether it was Deep Space Nine or Next Generation, and you look at the popularity of shows like that, and then you look at the popularities of, like, Battlestar Galactica. Television audiences are more than happy, a show like Supernatural, to embrace the supernatural, the fantastic, the otherworldly. And then when you look at the popularity of all these animated superhero shows over the last 20 years, everyone talks about, you know, the Batman animated series. Well, there's been like 10. You know, there was Justice League, there was Superman, there was all the X-Men cartoons. When I see the popularity of both those sci-fi type shows and then these animated shows, I think that if a live-action superhero show was done properly, it would succeed. The problem is you get stuff like that Justice League live action from the 90s.
Oh,
you know, the bootleg because of that. You know, you can't make it Justice League 90210. I think there needs to be a balance, like with what Smallville did, with what Arrow, you know, appears to be doing from what I've seen. But I do think that if it's done right, it could be a really good show. And I don't know. You know, we'll see what Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. does when that debuts in fall.
I was about to mention that. I heard that at the Comic-Con that it you know, I guess the pilot was shown. I think it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing where Whedon gave the impression it was just going to be like a snippet, and it ended up being an entire episode of S.H.I.E.L.D. And from my understanding, it went over very well with the audience. So, and actually, you know, Whedon seems to be very, very adept at navigating this world, you know, with the Buffys and the Fireflies, and also what was the character? The other one, the spinoff,
Angel,
the spinoff from Buffy. He seems to be able to know how to do this. So I think it's unfortunate he didn't have a chance to, you know, take the Wonder Woman thing to fruition. But maybe it's good that we have Avengers because of that. But
exactly, that shows you how idiotic DC and Warner Brothers can be. Is they, you know, they had this billion-dollar guy, and they let him go. And that Wonder Woman, I don't know if any of you saw the Wonder Woman pilot.
Oh, I did. Oh, it's horrible.
Okay.
And you know what? And you know what, Dave? That's another one where, as a black person, if you get my inference, you'd want to walk out on that one too. Because they did some old ghetto sob story from like 1970.
Yeah, no, it was that, and Beverly Hills Cop pilot was on par with Wonder Woman pilot. It was that level of bad. Although Wonder Woman probably was a little bit worse. Wonder Woman,
had,
I was thinking about it.
And you had a talent connected to that too. Who's the gentleman behind that
David
one?
David Kelly.
Yeah, and I mean, this guy owns network television, and it still sucked.
The funny thing is, the best pilot DC's come with the last 10 years never made it to air. There's still people that are downloading the Aquaman pilot. There are still people who care. Yo, I saw this on iTunes. Did they make any more of this Aquaman? This looked cool. Nah, bro, that was the only one. Why did they want to do this other series? I can't tell you, man. It's Warner Brothers. Now I see why you're so mad at them. Yeah, now you see. Can I get another double shot of Jack? Thank you. You know?
Yeah, I think what it is, you know, this long-time rivalry between DC and Marvel. DC just, they're so desperate not to be like Marvel that they are paralyzed. Because the way they're doing things, you know, first you hear there's going to be a Flash movie in 2016, then the JLA in 2017, and even this Man of Steel 2, Batman vs. Superman, I would really be shocked if we see it in 2015, because what kind of movie are you going to put together rushing it like that?
You put together Green Lantern or Jonah Hex. That's what you do. And
yeah.
You know.
Oh, I forgot about Jonah Hex. Oh, God.
Yeah. Well,
now, Jonah Hex on the surface, that with this horrifically scarred horrifically scarred Western hero, if you did it in a gritty kind of fashion, like a low tech Western, it would have been excellent. Somehow it sucked.
Wait, yeah. And Brolin did a great job as Jonah Hex. This is what the tragedy of Jonah Hex is. Brolin did a great job as Hex. When they introduced the supernatural stuff, you just rolled your eyes like, oh, God, where are we going with this? The only thing would have been worse would have been them to introduce time travel. Have a boom tube come and just zap Brolin into the year 3000. That would have been worse because then they fudged up the supernatural in there. They would have fudged up time travel, too.
Well, listen, okay. We only got about 4 minutes remaining, unfortunately, before we go to the next show. But I do want to mention one quick thing, and it actually involves Dark Horse in a way. We never got a chance to talk about Image, the resurgence in Image's popularity because of its genre comics line. That the books that they're putting out now aren't necessarily superhero themed. And even yesterday, I tried to get Clones. That was sold out. It's already in a second printing. There's another book. What's the other book that is out too? Ah, jeez. It's several books under the Image line that are not comic book oriented. I should say not superhero oriented. And now they're becoming known for being like the comic company that does all these genre books that are not, you know, it's like the anti-Marvel. After all these years, now it seems like Image has kind of found itself, and I believe Clones has been greenlit for a TV show, if I'm not mistaken. What's your thoughts about? And Dark Horse is doing the same thing. So what are your thoughts about these comic book companies that all of a sudden are not superhero fair?
I consider that a misconception because Image has been doing this for the longest, all right? They've been putting out books that have not been superhero books for the longest. Walking Dead, Shadowhawk. You know, Shadowhawk on the surface is a superhero book. Underneath, it's a thing all about the AIDS virus and racial tolerance. You know, they've been taking experiments ever since Jim Valentino was inviting new talent in with them. Remember, true Image, we wouldn't have Hickman. If it wasn't for Image, we wouldn't have Bendis. If it wasn't for Image, you know, there are writers that came up true Image that are affecting everything going on. Azzarello. You know, so that's Image, Dark Horse, Dynamite, Boom, they're taking more risks. They're like, we're not locked in a bubble. We're not locked under trademarks. We can take risks. And it's working out because we're getting new talent.
Captain, quickly, you have the snippet for the Spock song to go out, you know, because I can't access it.
Of course, sir.
Okay,
not
I'm just making sure. I feel like I'm Matt Murdock right now. I'm just, you know. and what about you, Dave? I mean, you work for Dark Horse. What are your thoughts about this resurgence in? I mean, your property isn't necessarily. It's more sci-fi than it is as far as like straight superhero fair. That speaks to something.
We have a minute.
I just love I love comics as a medium. I love superheroes as a genre, but I love comics as a medium, and so I think that, you know, all my favorite titles out there right now are being published by a company called Monkey Brain. They publish exclusively to digital, and then some of the stuff gets reprinted later, but everything that Monkey Brain puts out that I'm reading, I'm loving. Edison Rex, High Crimes, Amelia Cole, and they run the gamut of different genres. And so I love that. I just love reading really good material. It doesn't matter what genre it is as long as it's good material. So that's what I get excited about.
Terrific.
All right.
Listen, Dave, we're going to have to cut it because of our crappy technology. But we're going to have to get you back You're always welcome to give us your information and really sell your wares on our show. So, and hopefully we'll meet up at this coming New York Comic Con. So it should be cool. But I'll keep in touch for if you can come by again.
Yep, most definitely. Let's do that.
All right, folks. We're going to go next door to AfroNerd. That was Dave Walker. We have, of course, you have to thank Daryl B. And the captain, we got to move on up. And we'll do it again next week for the Comic Shop. Next, AfroNerd Radio.
Spock with a beard?
I think not.
Black people say that so-and-so set us two steps back. Now, just to see how far back black people are right now, we got a chart provided by the American Black Progress Association. Now, let's check out the chart. Now, you also hear black people say that we're almost there. Well, as of today, there is 3,653 steps away. Now, every time we've made strides, we've been upset by missteps. You know, in 1960, SNCC and CORE stayed sit-ins. It's a great time for black people. You know, putting us ahead four steps. One, two, three, four. But in 1988, the Crips and Bloods stayed shootout, putting black people six steps back and 6 feet under. Hey, now what happened? Roots comes on, gives black people a sense of pride. 5 steps forward. And Roots begins a trend of names, of African names, beginning with Kizzy and Kuta, and ending with Sucretia Beyonce. 11 steps back. 11 steps back. Beyonce. Come on. What else happened? Mae Jameson, the first black woman to go out of space, blasts us 15 steps ahead. But then Little Kim, the first black woman with a kitty out, let us love it. 42
steps. Astral Nerd, take
yeah.
it, sir.
I don't have access to the boards. I was hoping I told you I can't get to it, man. It is what it is. I was hoping you were gonna go into the Astral Nerd intro.
Couldn't find it.
All right. It is what it is. Folks, this is the AfroNerd Show, AfroNerd Radio. Technological mishaps all around. These things happen, but it is August 3rd. Your heroes have arrived. It doesn't really matter. We can still get funky if we need to. Captain, what I want you to do, just put in the date. Put in July, not July, you know, 7.3, what is it? 7. 8.3.13. And you should get some new music there. It should be. If you put 8. 8.3.13, and you should come up with some jammy jams. I think there's a cut by the James Hunter 6. James Hunter 6.
Anything coming up here?
If you put 8.13, I mean sorry, 8.3.13. Today's date. I just hate it when the systems go down.
Nope.
It sucks.
Nothing's come up? Nothing's coming up.
All right. Well, you know what? Let's just power through, and hopefully I'll figure out something. folks, again, this has been The Grindhouse, August 3rd, 2013.
Wow.
What happened?
My board just went blank. Oh, man.
What happened now?
My board just went blank.
Your board went blank now?
Yes. four.
But we're still speaking.
Yeah, I'm still speaking, but it's like it froze here.
We have clips to play also, by the way, but these things happen.
All right, we just have to freestyle it. Another problem. We're professionals. That's what we do.
Yeah. Well, and you can't even see who's listening in, right?
No, that's the aspect that froze. There's nothing there.
Oh, great.
When it comes to that. That's the aspect that froze.
Well, hopefully, I suspect this might be something going on with Blog Talk. Because I'm having difficulty even getting into Blog Talk. I can't seem to get in, period, into Blog Talk. It's just not allowing me to get in. So
Well, before we start, let me just read off this statistic, Sir Aphila. Let me just read off this statistic. Now, who is the most educated nationality? I just want you to think about that for a second. Who is the most educated nationality?
Notice in the states.
Didn't say race.
In the states.
Okay, yes, in the states.
Mm-hmm.
Notice I didn't say race. Now let me get into it. Nigerian immigrants have the highest level of education in this city and nation. This is according to the Census Bureau. Although they make up only a tiny portion of the U.S. population, a whopping 17% of all Nigerians in this country held master's degrees, while 4% had doctorates. This is according to the Census Bureau. In addition, 37% had bachelor's degrees. To put these numbers in perspective, 8% of the white population in the U.S. had master's degrees, according to the census survey, and 1% held doctorates. About 19% of white residents had bachelor's degrees. Asians also come close to Nigerians, but they're not as good as the Nigerians. Now, you see, they will tell you that the black hegemony, cannot learn. They'll tell you that. Black people, you can't learn. Now, why does the Nigerian man have the edge? Some will say they have two strong Marcus Garvey principles. One principle is, you do not leave somewhere to do worse than what you were doing in your homeland. The next principle, a la Marcus Garvey, is that they're attached to Africa. And the black man here, the American black man, the American, what they like to call the Afro-American, is not attached. Among other things, there's other reasons also. But the point is, these are your Nigerian brothers. They group all of us all together and say the black race. They don't this, they don't that, they don't this. The great Afrinner talks about that we're individuals. So here comes a group of individuals who are doing very well. Now the question is, why can't the American black man figure it out? A lot of people would say, well, the Nigerian black men were never slaves. Well, I don't know if that's actually true. We've all been subjected to white supremacy all over the world. Now, the question again is, why can't the American black man figure it out? These are the statistics. These are the statistics. That's all. I just deliver the statistics. Back over to you, Sir Aphilnerd.
Yeah, well, I'm going to try to attempt to reboot the entire system, so let's see how that works out. But we'll see. But what you said is quite profound. I'm not going to dismantle or challenge the statistics. I remember reading that somewhere as well. I just find it fascinating that we seem to not be able to get around what has happened to black folk in this country and black American culture, and how it there's aspects of it that are regressive, that are rife with victimization, And I believe I even sent something to your attention earlier today with someone who I consider to be a friend of the show, who we interviewed, I think maybe first couple of years, Ill Smooth, a gentleman by the name of Ill Smooth. He also was a legendary radio DJ for the Underground Railroad, which is part of Pacifica Radio. And I believe they have the distinction of having of being the longest running hip-hop show, the Underground Railroad. And I would implore our listenership to actually check out, go to Pacifica Radio, or just simply Google the Underground Railroad. And Ill Smooth has a couple of websites himself. So he's definitely a media personality, or I should say a cyber personality. And I respect him, but he really weighed in and came hard on the Don Lemon diatribe that he had last week. You know, for those who may not know, we've covered it a couple of times already, with Mr. Lemon from CNN, noted weekend broadcaster, commentator. He had a five-point program, kind of the talking points part of his show, 5 points that he thought that black folk should try to heed or should try to ascribe to, 5 points off the cuff. I believe he talked about the pants sagging, he talked about excelling in school and enough with the out-of-wedlock births. What else did he mention? I forgot all five, but they were pretty self-explanatory. Not really controversial. He aligned himself with Bill O'Reilly from Fox, and you can't do that if you're a black person. You can't do that. And he said, you could tell, listen, on this issue, I may have to confirm what Mr. O'Reilly is talking about on this issue. So there's a clip from Ill Smooth on YouTube, and I'm pretty sure on his own website. I think you go to illsmooth.com or illsmooth.org. And he really attempts to dismantle what Don Lemon was talking about. And it goes back to what we said last time, Captain. This whole thing about asking for correction in the black community, that because you're asking for the pants sagging to cease, and you're asking for perhaps respecting your women, not impregnating them and not marrying them, keeping your residence clean, those kind of things. They take that and they automatically jump to, well, this is not going to solve racism, this is not going to solve poor schooling. They start to say that, well, these things don't matter because they're not going to correct the things in the larger scheme. And I don't think that is what Lemon was talking about. So I'm very disappointed that once again we have a gentleman that I do respect. I think we just have an issue with this particular problem. But I'm dumbfounded that I'm hearing so many people say, since when did telling people to look after your appearance, to clean up after yourself, to do some things that are within your power, since when did that become controversial? It's only controversial for black people. And we're allowing it to be that way. And it's so, and the victimization thing, Captain, it's amazing to me. I should stop. It's not really amazing. It's disappointing to me.
There you go.
That we're not able to see, or some of us cannot see, that you keep on trying to coddle black people or protect them from certain things that they can do within their power. Because if you sit there and talk about we don't have this, we don't have that, you start to delineate the things that we can't control. Then you set yourself up to be a powerless being. And it goes back to learned helplessness, which is what this kind of discourse with what Ill Smooth talks about and some of these other folks that are weighing in so harshly against what Don Lemon is talking about. What you're doing is you are contributing to the notion of learned helplessness, that these folks are so unable to control their own actions, that the odds are so against them, that they can't do some things. They can't do some things to make their life better or to it wouldn't hurt. I don't think it means that, you know, if you're asking for some correction, it doesn't mean that you're asking for racism to go away, because I don't think anyone expects that. But you could be better prepared. A soldier is better. I said this before. A soldier does need to be equipped in order to fight a war. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to fight the war, but you might win a couple of battles, though. I even mentioned this on the last show, Captain, that bluntly, I had to interview a young man who came in dressed that way, and the CEO of the firm told me, humor him, but get his ass out of here. And mind you, this is for a firm where people were making 10, 20, 30 grand a month as far as stock research is concerned. So it is a very disturbing thing when potential is lost or opportunity. The opportunity was there, but he wasn't prepared for it. And now, how often is this kind of thing happening? This is a real-world, albeit anecdotal thing. It's an anecdotal thing. It's just my experience. But this guy wasn't even considered because he came in from jump with the whole saggy pants thing. He came in a streetwear for a professional position. But these folks will tell you, you know, he never had a chance or he's a victim. The opportunity was there, but he didn't come correct. I mean, I've seen it. I've seen people litter in the urban center without care. I mean, Don Lemon is not delusional. These things are happening. Why can't you tell people to correct these things just a little bit? I wish we had that clip. You still have no access to the board, right, Captain?
That is correct, sir.
Oh, Jesus.
I can see the call. We have a caller. It comes up, but I have no access to bring them in or out. Crazy. I've experienced this before.
You know, I'm beginning to think it's something going on with Blog Talk. I'm beginning to think that. And you can't play any music also, right?
Let me try and see if I could do that.
Because I might want to take a break while I'm trying to get things rebooted.
Let's see what comes up. Nope, can't do that either. It comes
all
up,
right,
but you can't play it.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay, no problema. But I do want our audience to consider a game. Check out what this gentleman is talking about, Ill Smooth. You can simply Google Ill Smooth. You'll come up with a whole bunch of stuff. But he's weighed in. His latest rant is toward this matter with Don Lemon. So it is what it is. We were supposed to do a blue area segment, Captain, and I don't have all of the facts in front of me, but I'll try my best to extrapolate what I remember about some blue area moments that actually folks from the Peanut Gallery, our own personal Peanut Gallery, they were sending us things it's cool that our listeners, it's excellent, I would implore them to do this all the time, that the listenership, if you'd like to contact us, simply send us an email at afronerdblog@yahoo.com. Again, afronerdblog@yahoo.com. And quite a few of our stalwart listeners have been sending us stories of excellence. So keep on doing that. Keep on doing that, because that's what Afro Nerd is all about. So one story is about a young lady. I believe she's 22 years of age, and I believe she is from Florida, but she found herself in London, in England, and I believe she studied to become a barrister, which is an English version of an attorney, or an English attorney. And I think she's working her way back to becoming an attorney in the States, but she became the youngest barrister. The youngest barrister of record, and she's a woman of color. So I think that is to be applauded. And it goes back to cognition. And also, I thought she was a person that was born across the pond. But it says that she, I believe she was from Florida, and she studied studied abroad. So I find that very commendable. So that's one blue area segment with this young lady accomplishing that, something that's of something of distinction. And another young lady who's far younger than her, I think she's just four, a young girl of African descent. She, I believe, is another young member of Mensa. I think she's 4 years of age. I don't have the young lady's name, but I believe she's four, and her cognitive abilities are far beyond those of mortal men. I don't know what her, I think she's probably a 160 or something crazy like that. But I believe she's only four, and she's recently been inducted into Mensa. See, these are the stories that we're not telling. You know, there's got to be, I know I'm going to go on my soapbox, Captain.
That's all right.
But there's got to be an infrastructure in place, which I think Afronerd seems to be the only place for this. I mean, there's other outlets. There are other outlets, but places that need to really ring the alarm, like Quasimodo, you know, ring the bell to let the world know, to let everyone know, not just black folks specifically, but black folks specifically, but not just black folks. Everybody needs to know that there are black folks out here, people of color, that are doing things that are not so stereotypical, that are amazing. And, you know, maybe, you know, they'll probably call me a Don Lemon, you know, Uncle Tom type thing. But you have to say some of this stuff. You have to provide the historical record for people to know that we're not what you think. And I think, you know, some of this would probably diminish some of this dysfunctionalism. Now, I know someone's going to rant and say, well, you know, that's not going to affect, you know, the school system and, you know, incarceration rate, the school-to-prison pipeline. They're going to give you a whole litany of things that will not be able to see correction because of what I'm saying. But I do believe that we start planting some seeds of correction, that some of these things would lessen. The reason why I asked you if you had access to the sounds, Captain, is because I was able to find that clip that I referenced last week of Chris Rock interviewing Reverend Jesse Jackson, and it's a fascinating minute or so clip where he talks, he rants like Don Lemon, and this was, I think, in 97, so now we're 16 years out now, I believe it's in 97. And he said, I'll try to find it if we have enough time. Hopefully, I'm rebooting now. Can't we, he was pleading to the Reverend Captain, can't we do some things? I'm trying to imitate. Can't we do some things? Can't we do some things as black people so that we can perhaps get a little bit of respect? Reverend Jackson wasn't answering that question. Wasn't really answering it, Captain. You know.
There's something I want to add just to build on what you said when you mentioned the prison pipeline. Now, I have to go back with statistics.
The school, the prison pipeline.
Yes. I have to go back with this. People hate when I do this. Now, I know it's not as simple as this, but maybe at times it is. Most of the prisoners, people who are in prison, not all of them, but most of them, the males I'm talking about right now, we're talking about black males, the quote-unquote what's supposed to be head of the household. Most of these prisoners, according to statistics, not according to the captain or not according to Afronerd, make that clear now, I'm making that clear. According to the statistics, most of these people who are incarcerated, the black males, they do not have a high school diploma, they do not have a bachelor's degree, they do not have a master's degree, they do not have a doctorate. Now, okay, that's one aspect, that's one half of the equation. We're looking to get equilibrium here. Now, here's another common thing with these individuals that's very common. Most of them have mothers, but most of them do not have fathers. Not all of them, not all of them. They do not have fathers. So now, we know about the prison complex and everything else. We know about the impoverished neighborhood situations. We know that the government is not doing anything. We also know that there has not been a race, a hue, a religious group, an ethnicity that has ever flourished by going to the government. They've done that too. But let's say forget about that. Common sense would dictate that if, just hypothetically speaking, you could travel back in time and give Raekwon, Pookie, a high school diploma, and had a father,
go ahead.
A father, he would not be in prison. Now, I'm not saying you cannot end up in prison. You're out in the bar one night, you punch somebody in their face, three guys try to jump you, you defended yourself, you didn't have money for the proper lawyer, and you end up in prison doing a year and a half on a, you know, some low-level manslaughter charge. Things happen. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking impoverished situations. So you went ahead and felt, well, this is the only way out for me. You see how that works? I know it's not that simple, but maybe at times it actually is. Something for the people to think about. There you go. That's all. Back over to you. Back over to you, Seraphim. Back over
yeah,
to you.
One more portion of the Blue Area segment. There's a gentleman who I saw on Yahoo, actually, a Yahoo News service. This gentleman admittedly was homeless, I believe, in the late 80s due to a divorce. And, well, I guess, you know, his homelessness is a little bit specious, though, because he did say that he was a business owner and that he had to end up living in his garage. So I guess in his place of business, he lived in a garage. So he was technically homeless. Anyway, he aligned himself with the homeless movement and had, obviously, empathy for those who found themselves through circumstances, all kinds of circumstances, out in the streets. And you can imagine living on the street is a hellish situation. So I thought it was pretty interesting that, and I hope this takes on, you know, the necessity is the mother of invention. And he has developed this kind of shelter, this makeshift shelter that I guess he said he's not interested in trying to make it into a business because he's looking at it as kind of an altruistic kind of thing, just trying to be magnanimous. He said that, you know, it costs for about $500, but essentially it's a rolling shelter that will keep you safe from the elements. It's a kind of an oval shaped, I guess, mini compartment, I can say, mini shelter that allows the person to put a sleeping bag in this thing. It has a heating thing. It has a toilet facility, and it has holes in it, obviously, for breathing and that kind of thing. But I hope that this thing catches on because and it also has wheels, so that way you can get around any sort of zoning situation. But I want to commend this man. He's not a man of color, which is, you know, not every Blue Area thing has to be so Afro-focused. But I thought that this was just a great story, that this is a formerly homeless person that has built this thing. I don't know if he's approached Kickstarter. I think people are throwing things at him to really get this thing moving. But you might want to simply go to Yahoo News Service or Google this gentleman that created this shelter, this moving shelter. I guess you could even attach it to a bike or something. But the fact that it could keep people technically off the streets, giving them something, some kind of emergency shelter. Heck, this is something that FEMA could even incorporate. I mean, this could be a big thing, a big thing. Someone caught up in a hurricane or Hurricane Sandy or some kind of natural disaster, you may need to use this. God forbid any of our listeners or ourselves get caught up in this kind of thing. But this, from what this gentleman has created, this is a bare bones, basic kind of thing to keep you alive, to keep you somewhat safe from the elements. So I thought that was a pretty commendable thing on his part, and he is to be applauded for this Blue Area segment. So we're going to have to boost up these Blue Area moments, Captain, but I thought that's something that the audience would definitely like to know about. And just simply Google some of this stuff. Google the young barrister, Google the young Mensa recipient, and also inductee, I should say, the Mensa inductee. And also Google this gentleman that has created this shelter that's hopefully, if it catches on, could help the homeless community. So that's the Blue Area segment. Captain, any thoughts on it? You, I told you about this gentleman. What are your thoughts about this makeshift shelter deal?
I love the idea. I just totally love the idea. It's great. You know, anything to help out those people that are, anybody that could fall upon, you know, bad times, this is excellent. This is excellent. Well, the Blue Area in general, Sir Afro Nerd, is an excellent thing. You know, it's a totally excellent thing. Because at times, people will say, it's what happens when your emotional brain triggers. They will say, we're dogging black people. That's not what we're doing. We're not here dogging black people. We don't do that here. We just bring things to light. The things that we bring to light are what you should be discussing, or at least some of the things you should be discussing in your day-to-day. And there's a pro and there's cons. So we like to highlight the blue area to bring you nothing but pros. So the blue area in general is just a great thing. And I'm happy we started doing this. Back over to you, Sir Afro.
Yeah, well, you know what? What we're probably doing is compartmentalizing blackness, I think. You know, we're trying to categorize certain things so you know what it is and what to look out for, and maybe something you may not want to align yourself with. Hence the term lower tier. Someone has got to identify certain cultural or subcultural standards, and in order for it to be known, in order for you to know, you don't want to be a part of that. Because what's happening is, it has happened, is that it's when you say all black people, it's a problem. You know, that might be what really is problematic with Don Lemon's rant. If there is to be a criticism of it. Because people are so fearful of dismantling the tribe, Captain. They're fearful of it.
That's true.
You know, because someone who is as learned and as accomplished as Don Lemon is not going to really align himself with Shaquan with the tattoo of his girlfriend on his neck. Let's keep it 100. Is he really going to associate with a person because they share a certain phenotype and a certain coloring? Are we supposed to be the same, really? But if you identify, because the white community, rather masterfully, are very adept at compartmentalizing and cataloging and categorizing their people. You know, the poor white trash, as a pejorative, does put down make it plain that they're not part of that scene. Because there's a culture that's attached to it. Honey Boo Boo and that crew represents a culture. And they don't want to be connected to the larger tribe. Black folks, you know, when he said black people need to do this, black people need to do this, black people need to do that, I understood exactly what he was saying. And I understand he was talking to the cheat seats. But if he was going to really lay it down thick, he would have said there's a segment of the black community that needs help, and they're doing it the wrong way, and these are the rules for them. Really for everybody, but this group out of the black community, or I should say that's a segment of the black community. That is an issue. There's a cultural issue there. Not over here, but there. But we're so caught up in tribalism that we're all brothers and sisters and we're all in it together. That's just not working. It's not feasible. I cannot go over the mountain with some of these Negroes, Captain. It cannot be done.
Oh, man.
if Shaquan has a rope around him and he's a rope and a rock and he's trying to throw the rock over into the sea, I hope he doesn't have his hand out expecting me to go along with him. No, bro, that's on you. I'm not going over the precipice. All right, anyway, moving right along. You brought this to my attention, actually,
yes,
Captain.
Sir.
And I don't know that much about it. I guess it's a pretty straightforward story. But from my understanding, the Smithsonian Institute is calling on the Martin family now. They want to take the infamous hoodie that he wore when he was killed, Trayvon Martin is, young Master Trayvon Martin. They want to, I guess, have that on display? Well, I mean, why else would they want that?
Well,
what are your thoughts about, what the hell? What is that?
Well, I always had a problem with Smithsonian Institute. You know, that's just my personal issues, you know. That's my personal issues. Because they're purveyors of a lot of disinformation. But a lot of organizations do that. We know that. CIA, NSA, you know, MI4, MI5, MI6, you know, and the list goes on and on. You know, it's just a regular occurrence in the world. But I was a bit baffled by, you know, outside of that, outside of my personal issues, I was a bit baffled that this powerful organization, purveyor of disinformation, powerful organization would want the hoodie that Trayvon Martin apparently was killed in. It seems a bit strange to me. You know, what's going on? I just thought it was, you know, strange, and I thought it was newsworthy. You know, why would you want that? What, they want to tell the story? Because normally when you display these type of things in any type of museum, any type of institute, there's going to be writings below it, you know, descriptive language. So I would be very, I am very interested in seeing what they write below this and what would be said, you know. But I find it rather intriguing. That's all. That's all, Sir Affleck. That's all.
Well, you know, what it really tells you, Captain, and which really troubles me, is that the Trayvon Martin case, sure, it's a part of history. I mean, now it is part of history. But I don't know if it carries the same historical relevance as, let's say, the case with Emmett Till.
Yeah, that's a different story.
You know, Emmett Till has a lot of historical relevance and attachment. It has a movement attached to this thing. One could say that was a linchpin for the civil rights movement. It happened in 55. Now, 55 is the same time that the Board versus Board of Topeka, Kansas case went through. Board of Ed case came through. I mean, you know, you had the Montgomery bus boycotts at that time. I mean, 55 was a seminal year. Rock and roll. I mean, everything is attached to the mid-50s going into the 60s as being really a complete upheaval of America, of America's mores. And it was a way that America had to look at itself inwardly as to how they treated the races and the racial line. I mean, everything was dismantled because of that. So, I mean, and plus the what happened to him was pretty clear. You know, it's less ambiguous to me than the Trayvon Martin matter. The Trayvon Martin matter is not like the racial moment or the racial story. I mean, O.J. has more, the O.J. case, as far as the case of the century, has more relevancy because of him as a historical person and what happened thereafter, as opposed to Trayvon Martin. I mean, the whole thing is I don't know. I think they're being somewhat premature as to the importance of this thing as far as the historical. I mean, the Emmett Till case was so horrific that we're still talking about it. We're still, his mother just passed maybe 5 years ago. So, I don't know, Captain.
I'm there with you. I don't know. I don't know.
You know? I mean, is anything? Yeah, I thought there was a standard.
And I'm not putting it down, but I'm just saying that as far as, like, what is considered part of history, of major history, and for it to be displayed, like the Emmett Till thing, I could see that being displayed. I would want to see something of the Emmett Till thing, because that was what they did to that 14-year-old boy was incredible. So, I mean, as horrific as to what happened to Trayvon, it was a horror show too. But you know, it's so many. You know, the perp, if you want to call him that, you know, he's not a white person. He's not part of the black white racial dynamic.
But some of the cheap seats, I like that terminology, by the way. Some of the cheap seats not the mid tier, the higher tier. Cheap seats tried to compare it somewhat to Emmett Till. Some of them were doing.
They're doing a disservice to Emmett Till by doing that.
Yes.
They really are. It's just completely a different world. Completely. I don't want to rehash the Trayvon Martin case, but I think it's somewhat disrespectful to compare the two cases. The two different worlds we're living in. I hate to say, for the lack of a pun. The world was more black and white in 1955 than it is now. Now it's black, yellow, white, brown, and red. And that makes it different. Moving along, there's still a lot more topics to get into, Captain. As a passing story, you know, we spoke about this behind the scenes, and I really didn't want to talk about it because on some level I just don't have that typical/stereotypical black passion when someone were to call me the N word or the nigger word, you know, nigger. I don't make that distinction, and I know some black folks have some weird law on the books that nigger is distinctly different than nigger. But this football player, was it Riley Evans? Is that his name?
Riley Cooper.
I'm sorry, Riley Cooper. Unpack the story for us, for the listening audience.
Well, okay. Well, apparently, Riley Cooper, who is a wide receiver for the Philadelphia Eagles, football player, he was at a concert about 8 weeks ago, and someone videotaped him. You know, you have the great cell phone technology now. Videotaped him using the N-word. And he is white, by the way. He is white. Let's clarify this. Using the N-word in a derogatory fashion, which is an oxymoron, or as we're concerned here at Afro Nerd, that's the only way you can use it. But anyway, in a derogatory fashion towards a security guard at this concert. Then, you know, a couple of weeks ago, it decided to go viral. And then, you know, the media gets involved with it. The NFL gets involved with it. Now, according to the NFL, you know, when you sign these agreements, you do anything that could make the NFL look like a cheap seats league. I like that terminology, by the way. The cheap seats league. They can fine you. They can actually suspend you. They can also get rid of you. So right now he's on the bubble because he used the N-word at a concert in a derogatory way towards a security guard. So that's what's happening with Mr. Riley Cooper at this given point. And that's really it in a nutshell. So and all the media is going back and forth. Should they do this to them? Should he do that to him? Is this what he was really thinking and everything else? There you go. That's ultimately what it is, Sir Afro Nerd.
But didn't some of his teammates weigh in on this as well? Didn't Michael Vick have some words to say about this?
Yes, Michael Vick says, you know, Michael Vick said, well, I accept his apology. You know, people make mistakes. I made the mistakes. I made some mistakes via the dog situation and everything else. We know this guy. He plays football with us. You know, it may have slipped out. Sometimes you have these things on your mind, and he was drinking and everything else, and it just came out at the wrong time. Who knows what people are really thinking? He messed up. In this world here, America, you're entitled to get a second shot. I got a second shot. He should get a second shot. That's what Michael Vick said.
But didn't, was it him or was this another player that said that, you know, he will forgive him, but he's not really going to associate with him anymore? Or, you know, he went into him as kind of saying, well, you know, this guy kind of showed himself, and I, you know, it's not the guy I thought he was, and I'm not really going to associate with him.
Yes, there was another play, but I don't remember his name offhand, that definitely did say that. There was another play that definitely did say that. But being that Michael Vick is the starting quarterback, his words are holding more weight right now. And, you know, that's really what the media is propping up there, more or less, at this given time. But there was, you're absolutely correct, there was another player that definitely did weigh in. I just don't remember the play at this given time. Might have been a cheap seats play. I don't know. That's probably why I don't remember.
Well, I know I was talking to the Oracle about this, and a couple of things. I mean, first of all, he agreed like I do. I really have no feeling. I mean, for many years I've had. I do not have that, as I said, typical or stereotypical, typical and stereotypical reaction if someone were to call me a nigger. Especially, and I say someone, whether, I mean, I guess it would have to be a white person in order for me to have a reaction, or for me to have the reaction I'm supposed to have, it's supposed to be a white person who says it to me. And I'm wording it that way, Captain, because this is perhaps the positive result of black folk in pop culture using the word like Tourette's. I mean, you know, in everywhere you go, black folk need to say it on wax, you know, or they need to say it in some kind of pop cultural creative manner. It's so out there, and you have young, you know, the youth that insist on using it in mixed company, and then you have this confusion, this ambiguity with nigger versus nigga. I mean, even when they reported this in some of the ghetto-centric blogs, they were saying, well, yeah, he said the E-R. He didn't say the G-A. they're back to that. So, I mean, I don't know what to say, Captain. I mean, if you're going to report it that, well, the distinction for him is that he used the E-R, which means he really meant it. It's crazy. I don't have a reaction to this stuff anymore, as if I ever did. So I guess if there's a positive reaction to this thing, is that I have no reaction, I have no feelings. I don't get bent out of shape, or I would not get bent out of shape because a person of a lighter hue called me the N-word, because I really wouldn't like it if a black person was vulgar around me also and doesn't know me. You know what I mean? We've all used the word, maybe hypocritically, but not in mixed company, maybe in-house. The word is no longer an in-house word. We've commodified it. So, you know, other ethnicities have their own nigger word, nigger analogies for their respective races and ethnicities. But we have to guess if they use the word. You know, Italians have their words, Irish, Scottish, the Brits, everyone has their own words. Latin folk, everyone has their own words, but they use it internally. Even women, as a protected class, have their words, the B word or the C words. But I dare you to say it to a woman directly. You're not going to do that. They're not going to allow that, but among themselves, internally, not in mixed company, they may use words where the understanding is implicit. But with black folk, the world knows that we say these things. We've allowed it to be an outhouse word now. And many of us have made money, millions, if not billions, off of the word. Jay-Z is a multimillionaire en route to becoming a billionaire, I would suspect, for doing nigga music. I mean, so for Cooper to do this, I find it interesting that he is being ostracized, which might be, I guess, the right thing, maybe. That's what happens to you. That what happens to you is that if you're a white person and you use that word, and perhaps rightfully so, that's the only thing I can say that's a positive,
that you are treated like a ghost. You are put into a corner somewhere. We kind of know how you really are. You know, I think if you're in business, because sports, it's a business, you need to be as non-confrontational as possible. And you need to be acceptable to all groups. But these guys, you know, they're not the brightest bulb in the bunch. But just as what happened with Mel Gibson, used to be the top filmmaker, top actor on the planet. Now no one wants to do it. He's literally walking. He's a walking dead man. He's a walking dead man, at least career-wise. And I would say even socially. Even socially, people are like, hey, look at that guy. It's something really bad happens to you when you use an off-color remark like that racially. Paula Deen's kind of in that group, so you're put into the phantom zone. That's what happens. You're going to keep it nerdy today. It is the Afternoon Show. You're put into some kind of phantom zone, and this young man is finding out about that. When that other player said, you know what, I accept his apology, but I know how he really feels. I don't want anything to do with him. You're cut off. It's just not worth it. I'd rather have all my social access, Captain, intact. You know, if I did something off color, based on, especially since, you know, we are men of society, you and I, we have a reputation. We carry ourselves even outside of the show. We are respected. If I did something off color, I mean, I don't want to lose what I have. So I'm always thinking about that. I'm pretty sure you are too. I'm always thinking about how people perceive me. You know, I'm very trusted. You know, our gang, our inner sanctum, Captain, we play lotto and we play all kinds of games. And sometimes I will say I'm a little half-assed about giving out the information with the tickets. But you guys trust me implicitly that I bought the damn tickets, which I did. You know, and I appreciate that. I don't want to do something that would mess that up. So I'm very cognizant of the importance of appearance and what people think of you and morality. And this guy, this cat, I think he's in the same phantom zone as as our friend Mel Gibson, and also now Paula Deen. I'm pretty sure there's more to come if he insists on acting this way. One more thing, I see that the minutes are rolling on, Captain, even without music. Without our accoutrements, the show still goes on rather effortlessly, blah, blah, blah. There was a piece, I believe, in the Griot. Folks, I implore our listenership to go to thegriot.com. There's a piece that I'm pretty sure everyone has thought about, but they decided to actually write about this. Has R&B music been taken over by white artists? And I guess on the heels of Robin Thicke's latest Blurred Lines hit. And I have to admit, I kind of like the groove on it. It's definitely him channeling the great Marvin Gaye. It's a big hit. It's a huge hit. And then when you think of Macklemore and you think of Justin Timberlake, there seems to be Adele with 19, I believe, was her last song, or 19 or 21 or something like that. I mean, there's a whole list of, listen, for years there's been the blue-eyed soul category, but it seems less awkward now that you see white soul artists. I mean, I have no words on it because, hell, I'm going to go to the Afropunk Festival in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to see black folks doing rock and roll. The only thing is that we seem to be more receptive of white artists doing black conventional R&B. And yet, if we're trying to turn this thing around, for a genre, for both genres that we created, black folks doing anything now. Now black folks, have kind of squeezed themselves out of doing conventional R&B. Now we're so on the hustle, which is what hip-hop has become. Instead of having fun in the basement, because I remember what it was like in the nascent period of hip-hop
when there was a thing called The Basement, which BET even had a show called The Basement, where the creativity took place when it came to hip-hop. Those days are over. The days of going to clubs and the days of going to parks and honing your craft in the hip-hop world, those days are over. Now you have someone like Soulja Boy who can go and do, you know, get a little dap machine, if he even had that, and make some really grotesque song like Superman Dat Ho, I think, D-A-T. And it became a hit where he was able to garner some money off of this thing. I believe, you know, he looks like he's a millionaire unless he's just fronting, which I suspect he's probably doing the latter. But he attained some kind of success by being a kid in his bedroom fooling around. And it caught on. So I don't have any thoughts about Blue Eyed Soul. I mean, Hall and Oates did Blue Eyed Soul. It's not really new. It's just that for some reason, it seems like they've completely taken over the genre. When white folks were doing Blue Eyed Soul, and you might throw Tina Marie in that maybe, but I think she's so entrenched in black culture, I don't even think she would be considered Blue Eyed Soul. She was just doing soul music, but we still had a foot in it as far as new classic artists. What are your thoughts on this, Captain? I mean, what are we doing wrong? What's happening?
Well, I really don't, have an emotional thought pertaining to this. Some people get emotional, I'm hermetically sealed when it comes to that aspect, but I think music is music at the end of the day. If you can sing, and that's the way it should be, if you can sing, if you could really rap really well, if you could play an instrument really well, these are the people that should be getting the opportunity. Of course, I understand, from a marketing and promotion aspect, it helps to be good looking. But the core component of music is the music. So if the music is done very well, you should get an opportunity. I really don't care whether the person is white, black, Asian, or maybe even an alien, since we're heading that towards that way in the future. If you can perform and you could do the music really well, I'm listening to the music. And that's all that really matters at the end of the day. Give me good music. Give me good singing. Perform really well. Do a good job. That's all I'm saying. That's all I have on earth.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I'm not caught up in the color thing. I'm just not. But I'm curious as to what about black artists performing the music? That's my concern.
Well, they fell off a lot of them. You made an interesting point. They fell off a lot of them. Not all. But I would say that there's a good portion that did fall off.
But I think we're willingly giving up the music, though. That's my concern.
Yes, there may be some truth to that.
Repeat that, Kevin. I'm sorry.
No, I'm hearing something in the background. Like something.
Yeah, at the last minute I got on. Hold on.
Captain?
Yes, I hear you.
Yep. A minute left, and my board came up.
Yeah, you see? Wow.
And we had a caller here. I can't entertain it because we have a minute.
Yeah.
Captain,
my board came up too. It just came up. Oh, boy.
Maybe it's the NSA.
I don't know.
After all. Maybe it's the NSA after all. Not wanting this information to be disseminated. I'm just putting it out there. Any closing remarks about this? We have to revisit this. I think that we do need to discuss the music more often.
Yes, we do.
Just what's happening. I don't really care about white folks performing. I want good music, whoever's doing it. But I think black folks do need to be, we need to be more about better music, though. That much I think we need to discuss.
I agree with you, sir.
All right, folks, it's been a eventful Grindhouse. We'll do it again with better equipment, I think, for this Wednesday. It's been real. And we'll close on out with, oh, let's say, Rick James and Massive Attack. See you on Wednesday.
I really love to take her.